From the studios of Tucson Business Radio X, recorded in the Stewart Title corporate offices on Broadway, you are now listening to The Mark Bishop Show. And now here's your host, Mark Bishop.
Welcome to another Mark Bishop Show. My special guest has experienced the worst of humankind behind bars. But he refused to let that destroy him. He vowed that he would turn his life around and encourage others living on the edge to do as well as he has done. I want to welcome noted author, speaker, and coach, John Doc Fuller. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you, Mark? And thanks for having me on your platform.
Well, it's exciting to have you. Your books are marvelous, and what you're doing right across America is terrific. And that's why I wanted to have this interview with you. As soon as John was released in 2002, he began coaching others who were facing incarceration about how to make the best of their time in prison. In 2004, he formalized his coaching by founding Prison Coach Speaking. Now John Fuller is the most sought-after prison coach in the world. I guess the old saying of you gotta walk the talk is true in every sense of the word when it comes to you, John, huh?
Yeah, unfortunately that road traveled paid its dividends long-term, but it's nothing that I would suggest to anyone who was trying to reach success.
Well, in addition to being a nationally renowned prison coach, you're also an acclaimed motivational speaker and author. John apparently energizes his audiences to live his motto, which is motivation, determination, transformation. John, who would be most of your clients that you give these talks to?
Well, generally speaking, it's corporations, criminal defense attorneys. I go speak at high schools and colleges and an event that, you know, a client is having, you know, bouts of theft or fraud within their particular company, I'll be asked to come in.
Well, you're living proof that no matter how bleak a situation is, motivation and determination, it can lead to transformation. You're active throughout the country assisting organizations looking to implement prison reentry programs. How do you go about that? Give us an idea of what is involved, if you would.
Well, generally speaking, I'll go look at their mission statement and an overview of their program and try to ascertain what their goals are. And somewhere in 99% of the programs out there, there's a red line for punishment. And I'm not anti-punishment because that hasn't proved successful around the world. I'm a strong believer in reconnection because that's what's working in other countries. For instance, at one time, Portugal was in the same situation as the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2000, you know, they underwent a change because they had one of the worst drug problems in the world, much like the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And they had previously tried the American way of incarcerating people, and 1% of the people in the country were addicted to heroin. So the prime minister and the leader of the opposition got together and set up a panel of scientists, and they agreed in advance to support any findings of how crazy it might sound. Regardless, they were going to support it. So they took the loads of evidence, including their famed experiments called Rat Park. And the solution was to decriminalize all drugs, including cannabis, crack. But there was a catch.
Yes.
You had to use all the money that you spent harassing, prosecuting, and detaining people and spend that money on turning their lives around. And so they did some rehab houses and a huge program on reconnection. And if, let's say, for instance, you were a mechanic, they go to an auto body shop and say to the owner, if you employ this guy, we'll pay half of his salary. And it was much cheaper than sending them back to prison. So they set up a program with small loans so people who had addictions could set up businesses with their friends. And the goal, Mark, was that to say to everyone with an addiction or criminal history, we love you, we value you, we want you on our side, we want you back. And after 13 years, the addictions were down 50% and the overdoses were down more than 80%. And you know it's effective because the people in Portugal, they don't want to go back. And so, you know, as a country, we've copied everything that has failed. And one thing that I could say in defense of America's war on drugs and incarceration is that we tried. We've done it for over 100 years, spent over $1 trillion, killed hundreds of thousands of people, destroyed countries like Colombia, and on top of all of that, we can't even keep drugs out of our own prisons. And we pay people to walk around, strip search inmates, you know, the whole nine yards. And so good luck with that. So when I'm evaluating what a particular company or organization is doing, I really like to see what their end goals are.
Well, from, you know, that exercise you're talking about with Portugal, I mean, it sounds like it should be duplicated here without even thinking about it. You know, get on with it. It's a winner.
That's right.
Well, you're also the author of two books, John. One is The 10 Prison Commandments, The 10 Rules You Must Know Before You Enter a County Jail, state or federal prison for that matter. And the other book is A Day in Prison, An Insider's Guide to Life Behind Bars. And when you do have a few spare moments, John, I can see that you're an active contributor, ABC, NBC, Fox, Entertainment Tonight, Hollywood Access. So you're creating a little bit of interest. Let's talk about the books a little bit, John, if you don't mind. Give us an idea, please, you know, on the topics. How have these books been accepted so far in society?
Very well. In fact, some county jails actually use the 10 Prison Commandments as part of an orientation program for inmates coming into the prison. And so in that book are the 10 basic commandments, which are universal throughout the United States. In most prisons, you know, there are things that you don't do. You don't stare at other inmates. You don't necessarily trust them either. You respect your cellmates. You mind your own business. You respect the staff. You don't sneer. You don't snitch. You avoid prison gangs. You know, you stay away from drugs, and you don't gamble. And if you can manage to do those things, there's no guarantee that some rogue inmate won't want to hurt you, you know, out of initiation, hatred, or, you know, just a random attack. But abiding by those rules will generally keep you unscathed in prison.
Well, I guess what we see on television these days is hyped up a little bit to a degree, but is it a lot like that? I mean, you've been there, right? Is it like that, like we see on various episodes of shows in prison and the troubles that go on, you know?
Well, the problems, again, are universal, and every prison has its own identity. And the things you may see in a prison camp, you won't see in a low-security prison. You know, in a federal system, you know, you can have anywhere from 1 to 20 years. And there's a difference between that and going to a medium security prison where you can have anywhere from 2 to 5 years all the way up to 150 years. For instance, Bernie Madoff is in a medium, and he had 150 years. Well, the mentality in there is much different than, let's just say, a federal penitentiary like Lewisburg or Atlanta Penitentiary. Those guys essentially have nothing to lose, and they'll kill you in a heartbeat, and a lot of them will never see the light of day. You know, I remember sitting in the Atlanta Penitentiary and getting in trouble at some point, and I was placed in disciplinary segregation. This had to be 1993, and there were inmates in there who had been in disciplinary segregation for over 10 years. And a lot of these guys were Cubans that had came over on the merry old boat lift from, you know, Cuba, committed crimes such as murder and other crimes of violence. And they had no one to sponsor them on the street. But this was the makeup of the inmates in the prison system at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I tell you what, enlightening your books, I think people should read them. It opens your eyes a little, I'll tell you. Give us an idea, please, John, if you would, of the topics that, you know, when you do these big speaking engagements in front of lawyers and the heavies around America, public speaking on topics, what ethics, compliance, what do you mainly talk about?
I'll speak on ethics and compliance, the war on drugs, which can be a pretty lengthy, you know, conversation, transformation, identity theft, because I was involved in a lot of white-collar crimes prior to entering the prison system also.
Mm-hmm.
The prison system and incarceration, I'll speak to criminal justice classes, wardens, again, high school students.
How does that go down? How do the kids look at it when you open up?
Pretty eye-opening for judges who have been on the bench for quite a number of years, because there are certain things that judges and prosecutors are doing now that they did not do 30, 40 years ago. And so they don't necessarily have the insight or know the impact that a prison will have on someone that they are sentencing to 5 years of prison, where he could be on home confinement and probation and enrolled in some type of outpatient clinic if he or she has a drug problem. And so when you're speaking before these judges, you're giving them alternatives to incarceration, particularly individuals with nonviolent felonies or nonviolent crimes.
Is there ever a time that the judges pay trips to the prisons at all? Like a catch-up, how it looks today or whatever? I mean, they would never step inside those, would they?
Well, they do. However, any time that they perform those random walkthroughs or visits to prisons, it's always timed and scheduled. So prisons will generally take the worst inmates out of the prison for the day, put them in the hole, so to speak.
They get rid of them for the day, right?
Yeah. They'll stretch all of the guys who have complaints and grievances, legitimate or non-legitimate, against the prison officials, and they'll stretch them away for the day. You know, and once that walkthrough is completed, the judge has his perception of what prison is like. And inmates will continue to be frustrated because they know that he or she has not seen the real deal, so to speak.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's important. I touched on it before, but with school kids, when you speak to high school children around the country, you know, do they sit there with eyes and mouths wide open, or what's the sort of questions that they ask you?
What were my regrets? Did I regret anything about the life that I led prior to prison? And that's always a yes, because most people who are convicted of crimes and sent to prison don't account for the family members, whether it's the children, the mother, the father. If they were a breadwinner, they're not thinking about that. And so it's a huge disappointment if you've accepted responsibility for your behavior. You know, the people that you hurt along the way, if you've, committed crimes of violence at some point, then you really have to think about the victims. What impact did your crime have on the victims' life? You know, the young ones in high school now are very heavily influenced by music, violent video games, and a fast lifestyle. And so they're more susceptible to a lot of things than I was coming up. And I let them know, you know, a lot of things that they're experiencing aren't necessarily their fault.
No.
My generation let this generation down. You know, that anyone coming out of that crack era, whether you use drugs or not, where it was a very merciless generation, because the generation above me, they pretty much kept pornography from us. You know, if you've seen the Playboy book and the 60s or 70s, you know, you had to find it from a neighbor or some, you know, old guy at school had it and would show these things to you. But these children are looking at images right on their cell phones, you know.
Yeah, the access.
They
had
it much harder than my generation had it. Crimes that were committed, generally the whole neighborhood would be concerned about a young one who was going rogue. But now these children are so violent that you can't necessarily communicate with them the way we were able to communicate to those within our community while I was growing up. And so,
well, we got a very different set of circumciances these days. Different era.
Yeah.
It's the Mark Bishop Show. We're speaking with coach, speaking and consultant, prison coach, author, speaker, noted speaker all around the country, and a consultant to certain areas to do with the whole world of prisons. I mean, it's taxpayers' dollars, John Doc Fuller. John, I want to ask you about your particular thing. I don't want to elaborate too long on it because I never touched on it. I mean, you didn't murder anybody. You went to prison. You paid your time. What did you do to get in there?
I had conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute a kilo of cocaine.
Wow.
That was for my federal sentence and my state sentence that I did 1 year in prison for. I had forgery, utter forgery, and theft by deception.
Both of them sound like you needed a dollar, you needed a buck.
Absolutely. Fast money, you know, mm-hmm. back in the 80s, you know, I was living in Los Angeles and
right.
everyone around me was corrupt. I had corrupt lawyers, corrupt doctors. I had college professors who were looking to get their children into the USFL because they were a little old at 24, 25 to get into the NFL. And so they needed connections to get fake birth certificates and fake social security cards.
Oh, my God. So all this goes on, John, does it? All of this goes on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me, what are your views on the importance of prison reform?
Well, it's necessary, but the United States has never really gone about it the right way. Formerly incarcerated individuals have never had a seat at the table to implement, you know, meaningful ideas and programs that were put together from and by former inmates who have come home and actually been successful. Mm-hmm. You know, I honestly don't care how good the curriculum is. You simply cannot remove former inmates from the groups and classrooms as facilitators when it comes to training and preparing people to reenter society. And the United States, you know, for the most part, has done just that. You know, when these people who are sitting in groups trying to reenter society, and they see and hear individuals who have been in their shoes and come home and been successful, that has a much bigger impact than someone who has received a counseling degree from a local college, someone who has an MBA in psychology but has never spent the night in prison.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So, you know, you need someone who's been there and done that in order to really be successful.
That's it. Walk the talk. And that's what you're doing. How does true prison reform shape character, do you think, and life after prison?
Well, you know, first, if it's true, it'll teach you how to love yourself and listen to your inner voice. You know, you can't sit around and listen or walk with the voice or of fear or walk with people who bring doubts and fear into your life. You know, walking alone is, you know, one of the hardest walks you'll ever have in life because it's the walk that really makes you the strongest.
When you say love yourself, you work on that when you're inside. You realize your mistake. To go from one, it's the transformation from left to right, from I did wrong, I'm paying for it. What am I going to do later? Where am I at? Did you find religion inside?
Yes. Well, I was a spiritually conscious individual. I had studied the to be a Jehovah's Witness back in the mid-80s. And while I was in prison, I explored other religions.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't touch me the way being one of Jehovah's Witnesses did. And so when I came home, I continued to practice that. And, you know, I guess like most people, if you're practicing, you can stay out of trouble because, you know, you're accountable to someone other than yourself. But that is what has worked for me.
Right.
You are currently listening to The Mark Bishop Show, broadcasting from the Stuart Title Studio on Broadway in Tucson, Arizona. Back to the show.
Let's talk about the war on drugs. I mean, what's your take on it? How it began? How it's affected this country?
This is a 5-minute spiel. I'll condense it from 1 hour to 5 minutes.
I need two.
Well, okay. Well, in a nutshell, in a strange place to start, you know, Billie Holiday in Midtown Manhattan, when she walked into a hotel and she sang Strange Fruit for the first time. And it was about African-American men being lynched in the South. And the next day she got a call from a gentleman named Harry Anslinger. And he was a bureaucrat who had took over just as alcohol prohibition was ending.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a big government department with nothing to do. And two things he hated were drug addicts and African-Americans and Latinos. And so he began harassing and going after people who were heroin users, but Billie Holiday was his biggest catch. And he knew that he couldn't get into the clubs of Harlem, nor could any white man. So he got a black guy named Jimmy Fletcher to follow her and document everything she was doing. And he eventually arrested her, and she died pretty much in the custody of the federal government. And his laws went on to affect the United States for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
He had a huge role in the Boggs Act of 1951, and Nancy Reagan during the 80s continued with his campaign. And then if you go into the 80s, it was, again, a war on drugs, you know, targeting minorities, and it really hasn't stopped. It continued under George Bush after the assassination of Eddie Burns in Queens, New York, who was a rookie cop.
Mm-hmm.
And then even up until, you know, Clinton and Barack Obama, you know, Barack may have pardoned individuals and things of that nature, but right after that, you know, Trump has did some things regarding reentry, but his appointment of Jeff Sessions had some of Anslinger's legacy. You know, like Anslinger, Jeff Sessions said, remember back in 2016, good people don't smoke marijuana? The marijuana was legal until he made it illegal after the alcohol prohibition. So the war on drugs essentially started way back then and continues to this day, and it's been unsuccessful.
Man, I tell you, how can individuals, I want to ask you this one, how can individuals who are incarcerated be helped, who do not suffer from drug and alcoholic issues?
Well, I think that they have to get into successful mentoring programs and really combat and deal with criminal thinking. While I was incarcerated, a group of men and myself put together programs of our own because I was a classic example of someone who was involved heavily into crime, but I had no history of drug and alcohol abuse.
Mm.
And so the programs that helped me really were programs centered around a self-esteem because at the end of the day, when you feel really, really good about yourself, you're not going to go out and commit crimes. There'll be a connection to the community, a connection to your state, a connection to your country, and ultimately a connection to the world.
Now, that sounds wonderful. And maybe, you know, without being facetious, I don't, you know, I'm not saying it all sounds good in theory. but man still needs to work, right? And jobs are critical, no matter how much you feel good about yourself. So absolutely. You don't work and you don't feel valuable and all the rest of it, then the rest comes down with you. So, okay, that's a good, interesting point. But what do you think then has been the greatest change in society since your release from prison back in, what, 2002?
Yeah, I think that now former inmates, both male and female, you know, they're slowly being heard and afforded wonderful opportunities to obtain corporate positions in companies, obtain corporate sponsors for their programs and companies, and often sit at the board of directors for some important programs that deal with formerly incarcerated individuals. You know, with so many people being convicted felons, the world is accepting the fact that these mistakes won't freeze them in time or define them. And I think the second thing is that women are finally being heard, and they have a voice now to stand up against, you know, domestic violence and sexual assault and things of that sort, you know, because that's what leads a lot of women into crime and into the prison system, or traumatic experiences that they experience as children. Mm-hmm. So by the fact that, you know, their voice is being heard, I think that's a great move in society.
Do you think it's getting over the top? Do you think there's too many bandwagon riders with that? How do you define? I mean, I'm all for it, you know. I mean, the stuff that's gone on in the last 2 years, without mentioning a lot of names, but women are coming out of the woodwork, right? Now, how do you discern all the time that they're for real?
Well, you know, that's why I'm glad I'm not in a position to be the judge of that, because I think it's a very, very weighty responsibility to ascertain whether a woman is telling the truth or not. You know, if you've had a relationship with someone 15, 20 years ago, and now you're a wealthy individual, and this woman uses that prior history to make an allegation, that's bad. But unfortunately, in the world that we live in, there's no defense for betrayal. Whether you're in a marriage or someone was your girlfriend 20 years ago, there's absolutely no defense for betrayal. And so I think judges have to sort through these things, as well as juries, very careful, in addition to people having a moral compass and not using money as a means to become successful by bringing someone down or destroying their lives.
We're going to be closing soon, John, but I want to ask you a couple of questions that, you know, are always hanging out there when people say, look, you know, you put people away for drugs, this and that, for selling drugs and for distributing and dealing in drugs. But there's a demand, isn't there? The white-collar worker, the successful business guy, you know, it's supply and demand, correct? It's still there, yes?
You mean the sentencing?
The need for drugs is still there by the worker and by people who you may not think would be on drugs, you know, professionals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you think about the crack epidemic, do this in under 30 seconds, you know, there were people sitting in prison for 100 grams of crack. They were given 19 years for $100 worth of crack. You take cocaine, you put some baking soda, you add a little water to it, and now it becomes crack. Whereas drug users, who were primarily, you know, business individuals, more white than black, they were using the drugs and sometimes would buy $200 worth at a time.
Right.
And they would get a slap on the wrist. But I think America now realizes that the prisons are overpacked, and that these young people who are selling drugs and crack and things of that nature, if they're selling it and they have no weapons, that they're trying to keep them out of prison or steer them guys into some sort of reentry program.
Right,
but
right.
Disparity remains.
Well, that's the next thing. I mean, the prisons are overcrowded. But what do you do where, you know, I mean, I guess you've got to start looking at the whole system and reforms on the particular charges. And I know that it's a mess, isn't it? I mean, what do you think of the idea of more private prisons versus federal? I mean, is there a for and against with all of that? I mean, because let's face it, they're a business, right?
Well, prison, the prison business?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very deep question. You can have a local prison, like Larry Holmes owns a private prison over in Pennsylvania. And you can, you know, it's a business. But to close the federal prison system, we're not going to talk about the state, but even a federal prison, you have to understand that they have unicorn industries in these prisons, industrial complexes. They're building weapons for the army, inmates are. They're building desks, mattresses, clothes for people in the military, and they're getting paid, you know, $1.50, $2 an hour to do these things. And Unicor Industries is on the stock market. So to close down the federal prison system, you actually have to close down businesses and their means of making and generating money for the military by creating these parts and other things. So it's not just closing down prisons that you have to think about, but you're affecting part of the economy when you're closing down something that's on the NASDAQ.
And yet they're only paid $1.50 an hour or something. What's the story on that inside? I mean, do they ever go on strike? Do they ever get very upset of the minimal amount of money they're making?
It all depends. Some institutions do, but you'll never, ever hear it publicized. Because once it becomes public, then what you're doing is paying inmates low wages, which are pretty much slave wages. That's what they're getting paid in countries like China and India and, you know, other countries. And so what makes the United States any better by paying someone $1.50 an hour?
While they're incarcerated, they're paying back to society, it could be said.
That's not paying back to society. You pay back to society by training an individual to contribute to society and have a connection to society. Generally, the society's not only people benefiting are the officers who work within the prison. They're benefiting because they have jobs. But that has nothing to do with paying a debt to society or rehabilitation. I have someone I've known for 35 years who's been in prison for over 30 years for attempted murder. And his victim has come up to see him, and he's still been sitting in prison for 30 years for attempted murder. And everyone in the world has gone to bat, from the general manager of the Sacramento Kings, MC Hammer, news correspondents. The world wants to know about Damon Cook now. That is the new thing when it comes to paying a debt to society. You have rapists and murderers who have gone home in light speed in comparison to someone like Damon Cook, who has sat in prison for 30 years as a first-time felon. This guy had a degree from the University of Las Vegas in finance. The only crime he ever committed was the assault or attempted murder of someone who stole something from him. And for that, he's been in prison for 30 years.
On the face of it, it seems absolutely ridiculous, doesn't it?
Especially when the Supreme Court has said to let you out, and the state of California has refused to do so.
Supreme Court has said that. Yeah. Well, you know, it's almost like every case is on its own. You know, you've got to look at each case separately, haven't you? I mean, but the law says you know, attempted murder is attempted murder. But what are the circumstances? But 30 years, I think, is long enough. You know, I don't think he's going to get out and try and murder anybody else, do you?
Well, I know what. The parole board continues to deny him. This is a guy who has had major corporations in Silicon Valley say, if you release him, he can come work for us because he's developed computer coding classes. He's facilitated every type of program known to man. He has a plan to establish housing for reentry throughout the United States, much like your mission. And entertainers and athletes have gone to see him. In fact, the Golden State Warriors have brought their basketball team up to hear him talk. Wow. And the San Francisco 49ers have brought their rookies to the prison so he could speak to the rookies about not making a mistake that he did.
That's fantastic. What's his name again?
His name is Damon Cook, D-A-M-O-N-C-O-O-K-E. Damon Cook. And just Google this man.
All right, and he's incarcerated where in California?
He's incarcerated at Solano Prison, S-O-L-A-N-O.
Solano Prison. Okay. All right. Interesting story, that one, I'll tell you. We're going to be running out of time soon, John. I would like people who are hearing this particular podcast with you, if they'd like to contact you, either a speaking engagement or even just to talk to you personally. You're a hell of a nice guy, and I'm pretty sure you'd want to help people. You've been doing it for many years now. Your website URL is prisoncoachspeaking.com. That's correct?
Yes.
Okay. You can be got on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/prisoncoach, prisoncoachspeaking. That's your Twitter URL, John Doc Fuller. Where did the doc come from?
I was a huge Julius Irving fan when I was young. And so the doc just kind of stuck with me, so to speak.
Okay. John Doc Fuller on Instagram. It's all there. But now, listen, here is a phone number directly to your office over there on the East Coast. 732-831-7400. 732-831-7400. You know, I would love to. I mean, we could go a few hours talking about this. A million questions from the public's point of view, from outside point of view, that I would like to ask. What goes on, how and who and where, and the blue collar and white collar and the murderers of the world that will never get out versus, you know, somebody in there for smoking a bit of pot or doing this or doing that. I think there's a lot of people in the jails that need help mentally and to be able to, you know, get off drugs more than any crime they've ever committed. You've seen plenty of that, yes?
Absolutely. It is, like you said, we could sit and talk for hours. For hours.
John, I thank you for the 40 minutes you have given me. My special guest has been John Doc Fuller, nationally renowned prison coach, acclaimed motivational speaker, and author. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Mark Bishop Show. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you listening.